Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. Tell us what you think of it by leaving us a review on iTunes or by letting us know on Twitter or Facebook.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for spending this hour of conversation with us. Taking what belongs to you. You can hear it there, chanting in Russia, but can you hold on to it? The crisis in Ukraine has become the crisis in Crimea over Russia claiming that it's entitled to retake Crimea after the Russian majority there voted to secede. We'll explore that this hour. Also, trouble in the auto industry regarding product recalls. There's still nothing much to report on the disappearance of Malaysian airline Flight 370, and that's why it's still one of the biggest headlines in the world right now. We'll have an update. Also, a look at education in America, higher and lower. But first, by the end of the week, the Russian parliament, the Duma, will have formalized what the international community is calling a land grab and a legal travesty, and what Russian leader Vladimir Putin is calling a restoration of the natural territory of Russia. Either way, the annexation of Crimea is looking increasingly like a fact on the ground for now. Russian forces and local militia there have reportedly taken control of Ukraine's naval facility within the last 24 hours. It is also the case that you can only get to Crimea from Russia right now, by air at least. International sanctions and non-recognition are starting to be felt inside Crimea, and it appears to U.S. Vice President Joe Biden that they are also being felt in Russia.
Russia's political and economic isolation will only increase if it continues down its current path.
Vice President Biden issued that statement yesterday, traveling in the region and meeting with Ukraine's neighbors, including the foreign minister of Poland, anxious to hear reassurances from the U.S. about pledges of common defense and the obligations of NATO, now that the alliance is suddenly back on the front line in the strategic situation in Europe after years of involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan. Joining us now is Lilit Gevorgyan, senior economist at IHS Global Insight. She joins us from London. Welcome, Lilit.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's get right down to the details here. Ukraine is supplying Crimea's electricity. What other details in this sudden secession still have to be worked out?
Well, of course, as you mentioned, electricity supply, energy supply really is one of the key issues. Also, the peninsula's new government has taken decision to move to Russian ruble, abandoning Ukrainian hryvnia, which is also going to be economically a slightly painful process. On top of that, there is a process of nationalizing the assets and companies that have been formerly owned by the Ukrainian government. So there will be a short period of economic turmoil for the peninsula, and also making sure that the energy supply from Ukraine is uninterrupted.
Now, is that going to depend on cooperation from Ukraine? Is it going to depend on safe passage over Ukrainian territory or Ukrainian sea lanes for any of this to take place?
Well, we're really talking about the peninsula being part of the electricity grid of Ukraine. Russia hasn't got the logistics and hasn't developed its LNG capacity as far as to replace any shortages by other means. So yes, indeed, it has to depend on cooperation. But ironically, we have a situation where Ukraine really depends on Russia on its energy input, and this newly emerged breakaway peninsula depends on Ukraine almost 100% for its energy imports. So all sides involved in this triangle have to find way to ensure that there is some understanding that the population of Crimea should not suffer because of the political fallout.
Well, let's clarify for a moment. You referred to the LNG issue. Theoretically, Russia could replace energy in Crimea with liquefied natural gas, but the logistics of doing that, the infrastructure for doing that, would have to be created almost overnight, as you refer to there. All right, let's get bigger picture here. Russia could turn off some spigots to Europe if it gets sufficiently upset about sanctions. What is the dependence on Russia vis-a-vis Germany and the rest of Europe?
We have to be very clear when we talk about Europe's dependence on Russia. As you mentioned, indeed, there are some European Union countries that are more vulnerable to any potential fallout, economic fallout with Russia than others. For example, Germany, Holland, Poland, Italy. These are the countries that have a bigger trade turnover with Russia. Having said that, I have to emphasize that even the Russian officials are already admitting that there are signs of economic crisis, and any standoff, any sanctions will only aggravate the situation for Russia. So I believe that Russia may lose more than European Union.
Lilith Gevorgyan is a senior economist at IHS Global Insight. She spoke with us from London. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Going to college and getting an education. There's your book learning, and then there is learning the hard lessons of life, in this case, college life.
I came to school not understanding the financial system, not understanding the loans that I was taking on. I have friends that are seniors, and I'm realizing more and more how much debt I'm going to be in once I graduate college.
Student Megan Pierce did not go to Fitchburg State in Massachusetts to learn about banking and finance or to end up with $30,000 in student loans. And learning the consequences of bad financial decisions wasn't part of the curriculum for Nakia McKenzie at St. John's University in Queens.
The debt that I have incurred now, I know I could have probably avoided it had I been more mindful or just, you know, open to knowing that, hey, you can't afford it, you know. I have a couple of friends now who have graduated, and Sally Mae is knocking on their doors, and they don't know what to do because they're even having tough times even finding jobs now. So, and they have their student loans to pay, and they're just freaking out.
Nakia McKenzie left St. John's eventually overwhelmed with student debt and is now a part-time student at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. These are voices gathered by our partner WGBH's Higher Education Desk, where they found Mike Wasserman, who's the Massachusetts Executive Director of the Boston-based nonprofit Bottom Line, which helped Nakia McKenzie out of her difficult college situation, and is advising student Jasmine Boyd Perry. Mike Wasserman and Jasmine Boyd Perry join me now. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Hello.
So, Jasmine, are you saddled with debt like those hard luck stories we've heard there just a moment ago?
Thankfully, not so much. I've managed to, with the help of my bottom line counselor, figure out my FAFSA and get it in on time. So it's not the worst.
Congratulations. And I'm sure that takes a little bit of the college pressure off. Mike Wasserman, what segment of the population are you looking to most help? And then we'll talk about some of the mythologies about college that kids and parents naturally fall into.
Yeah. So at Bottom Line, our focus is working with students who are first generation college students who are coming from lower income families. So really, students who have the motivation, the drive to go to college, but maybe lack some of the social resources or expertise within their family to really navigate what is becoming a more and more complex situation.
Did Nakia and her family, the story of the young woman who went to St. John's and eventually dropped out, were they just in love with the idea of St. John's and were blinded to the financial realities?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think there's a culture of the way we talk about college, which is, you know, just go to your dream school, you know, just make it work, whatever it costs, you know, it's worth it. And I think more and more people are starting to realize that you have to make more of a buying decision, right? I mean, college is the best investment you can make in your future, but that doesn't mean that every college is. You really have to be smart about making intelligent financial decisions.
Well, being a smart buyer is part of the problem in the sense that sometimes the information isn't readily available. Here's Rachel Fishman, who's a policy analyst from the New America Foundation.
There's differential pricing in higher education, and students can be getting need-based aid, merit-based aid, grants, loans, and all these factors have to be taken into account when making your college decision. And many students aren't able to do that right now because it's a really complicated concept.
Jasmine Boyd Perry, what complicated concepts are you majoring in college? And do you understand what Rachel Fishman is talking about there in trying to figure out the price of your education?
I do understand. Well, right now I'm majoring in psychology and sociology. But when I started out, I was incredibly confused about what it meant. And I applied to multiple schools. I applied to Temple, and I even applied to St. John's, and I got into these schools. But when you get your financial aid package back, you think, this is amazing. I'm getting $20,000. But what does this $20,000 break down to? And then how are you going to make up the extra $30,000? And what does that mean for you? What does it mean for your family? And it wasn't until I talked to my mentor about him and I sat down and I was realistic. It's, do I want to pay this much money for a name, for a dream, when I can get an equal education at a place that costs $10,000, that offers a better package? And sometimes you just have to face the realities of the situation. And that's why I chose UMass Boston.
Mike Wasserman, how difficult is that? I mean, how are you not the character who comes into the family and is basically selling my daughter short? You're the person who says she should accept her economic situation. I reject that. She's going to the best school.
Well, there's a lot of different colleges out there. I don't want to say that, you know, the cheapest school is selling yourself short. I mean, I think we really believe in the public education system. When you think about the Harvards and the Ivy League schools, you know, a student that gets in there from any background, those schools will give you a financial aid package that makes it work. So if a low-income student gets into an Ivy League school, a very competitive school, they can afford that. And A is making sure that students know that those resources are out there and not walking away from that. But, you know, a student that is going to choose between, you know, a large private urban school and a large public urban school, it's really just helping that family understand the financial implications of both. And I think we really believe that it's not, you know, you got to go to the worst school. It's just understanding the full decision making that has to go into, you know, buying a school.
Jasmine Boyd Perry, have you managed to put some money away, make some future plans, and not just worry about the debt you're going to be having the moment you graduate?
I've made some money, but it's a balance because I do still have loans. I don't want you to think that I'm going to school scot-free, but it's about what loans I'm willing to take out. Like, I make sure they're all subsidized, so I'm not accumulating, like, interest rates on it. I make sure that if I'm going to take out this loan, that I have a plan to pay it back. So right now I work and it doesn't pay the best, but I have enough. I get to have fun. I get to do things, but I also have goals. Like, I'm going to study abroad. So I made sure I made a financial plan that allows me to do that.
Does Jasmine's lack of pressure and sense of confidence, is that convincing to other people that come to Bottom Line with the financial problems, Mike?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, if you look at kind of the average student's debt coming out of college now, it's risen to, you know, about $30,000, really gone up significantly over the past decade. And that's just the average. I mean, you know, Jasmine's talking about the loans she's taking out. It's really about $5,000 in subsidized loans, and the pressure is so much lighter when you come out of school. I think it really allows you to do what you want and don't feel the pressure to, you know, get the highest paying job or feel like you're failing if you can't find that perfect position right away. So we've really tried to connect a lot of our current college students to high school students so they can hear some perspectives, right, on what it's like once you go to school and the freedom that good financial decision allows. And also, you know, to your question earlier, talking to students about the real quality that exists in affordable schools through honors programs, through study abroad, through all of these opportunities that, you know, a large public institution can provide or an affordable institution can provide.
Mike Wasserman is the Massachusetts Executive Director of the Boston-based nonprofit Bottom Line, and Jasmine Boyd Perry is a junior at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
For lots more on this story, including a video on student debt we shot with student Jasmine Boyd Perry, you can visit thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So, car trouble, folks. You having any of that? Just today, we learned that auto giant Toyota will agree to a settlement with the U.S. Department of Justice for as much as $1 billion in change to avoid criminal charges over the way in which Toyota handled safety problems that led to the biggest recalls in that company's history. While over at General Motors, the good wrench feelings post-bankruptcy have been tempered by the announced recall of 3.3 million vehicles. The circumstances of those recalls, some of which relate to safety problems linked to at least 12 deaths, are also being investigated by the Justice Department for possible criminal charges. Independent automotive analyst Michelle Krebs joins us now from Michigan. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you for having me.
So is that the cost of putting this behind it for Toyota, $1.2 billion or so?
Well, right. And I think what it demonstrates is this has been, you know, 4 to 5 years coming, and it's very expensive. Today's bill is $1.2 billion, and that doesn't count a lot of other things that were involved in this. And I think it gives us a clue as to what will happen with GM.
And GM is at the beginning of this road that really started almost a year ago. Describe, first of all, how they're dealing with it, what lessons there might be from Toyota, and how the new leadership is facing these problems.
Well, actually, they've known about this situation for about a decade, and what's the major problem is they didn't do anything about it back then, and it's only coming to light now. They only did the recall just last month. There is new management at General Motors. The government is now out of its business. The company is now led by the first female auto company CEO, Mary Barra, and a new team of executives. And they have been desperately trying to show that the new General Motors, out of bankruptcy, out of government ownership, is different than the old one, that it's nimble, that it's responsive. And to that end, Mary Barra has been out in front in the last week on this issue. She did a media briefing yesterday. She's done videos and has apologized. That is not something we often hear from General Motors.
Now, is it the case, though, that she was in the leadership team when this was all known about? And as her ascension was taking place, she understood full well that she was inheriting all of this and must have known on day one.
Well, she's an engineer. She came up through the engineering ranks. We will find out through congressional hearings and investigations who knew what when. She says that she knew about, some sense that something was going on with this in December as her appointment was announced. She was actually took the job in mid-January, but it wasn't until the end of January that they realized they absolutely had to do a recall.
The criminal charges that were considered for Toyota related to that surprise acceleration problem that Toyota at first didn't admit to and then has admitted to, and of course, as we mentioned, biggest recalls in that company's history. Describe the safety problems at GM and how they're linked to apparently as many as 12 fatalities.
Right. Well, the situation is vehicles, the Chevrolet Cobalt, some Pontiac and Saturn vehicles, had this issue with the key. So if you would put the key in, and if you had a number of other keys on, or you know how we all put things on our keychain, it would, if something jarred it as you're driving, it could the weight of the things on the keychain could pull it down and pull it out of the ignition, which would shut off the engine, shut off the airbag, shut off your ability to steer. By GM's own admission, 12 deaths and 23 accidents have been associated with this. And, you know, there could be more. We don't know.
I didn't even realize that actual keys were used much anymore in cars. I certainly have had a remote on the last two models that I've purchased, not General Motors cars, but keys seem to me a little retro.
Well, they are. These are old cars. These are from, you know, the mid-2000s. Now we see, yes, most of us don't use keys, or we have the key and put it in the cup holder and we push the start button. But these are much older vehicles.
And Barra will survive this? There's no question of a change in leadership at this point. How do you think she's handling it?
I think she's handling it as best she can, and certainly differently than we've seen General Motors, other executives. Even when the Toyota recall occurred, it took a while for Toyota to get out in front of it and be public about what they were going to do.
Michelle Krebs, independent automotive analyst, speaking to us from Michigan. Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Got an old school story for us. We are taking a look at classrooms around the nation, and we're asking you, what's a great story of lessons learned in the classroom? From Florida, I had a civics teacher who told me to believe nothing I see and only half of what I hear. Another of his favorite maxims was to trust the man seeking the truth and to be wary of the man who claims to have found it. As a result, I developed a habit of researching things of interest, anything from history, philosophy, laws. I get an itch when I don't know enough about a topic that interests me. Or Cedartown, Georgia. My best experience, or at least the one I can remember in the classroom, is as an instructor, not a student. The lesson it taught me was understanding cannot be guaranteed, even when students verbally tell you they understand, they need to show you.
Hi, my name is Michael Trent. I'm calling from San Antonio, Texas. In high school, my teacher told us that there was word that some of us were cheating in U.S. history class. She did this for several weeks. Her accusations became more detailed as we moved forward into the McCarthyism portion of the 1950s. One day, she announced she had found out who was cheating. Myself and two others were called out in front of the class as cheaters and asked to step outside. Fuming and furious, I was prepared to let her have it, as it were, as I had never cheated on anything. Only then did she tell us that it was a demonstration on everything wrong with the McCarthy era. An amazing lesson for all of us.
An amazing lesson, an amazing story. Thank you to Michael Trent there in San Antonio, Texas. Send us a story of your best experience, most memorable lesson taught to you by a teacher in the classroom. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, be a part of the conversation, or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. It's old school. Take it down to Mexico, she said.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
Now to a discussion of one of the tensest frontiers in the world that you never hear about, Israel and Syria's face-off in the Golan Heights. All through the three-year crisis and civil war that has ripped Syrian cities apart from Aleppo to Damascus, Israel and Syria have remained largely at peace in their military standoff in the Golan that has remained stable for decades. Now, recent attacks on both sides have raised the temperature. We're joined by former Middle East correspondent Matthew Bell, who reports for PRI's The World. Matthew, welcome.
How you doing, John?
Describe these latest attacks that have, one answering the other, and then let's explore some of the complications for both Israel and Syria in trying to keep this from becoming chaotic.
Yeah. The most recent one was on Tuesday, and it was an improvised explosive device along the fence on the dividing line between Israeli-controlled Golan Heights and the Syrian side. It was right outside of an Arab Druze village called Majd al Shams, I think is where it happened. And there was a patrol. I guess they got out of the vehicle. Explosion went off, and there were four Israeli soldiers who were hurt. There have been sort of errant shells that have come across into the Israeli side of the Golan Heights. There are lots of Israelis who live there. There's Israeli communities right up close to the dividing line with Syria. But this was serious because you had Israeli soldiers getting hurt. And then the Israelis responded very quickly with airstrikes against Israeli government forces.
And the complication here is that Israel has a stake in maintaining the stability of this border frontier, which would lead you to think that they are, supporters of Bashar al-Assad, who's helped to maintain that stability for decades, along with his father. But Israel also has a stake in fighting Hezbollah, which is at war with Israel technically on the frontier in Lebanon, and also supporting Bashar al-Assad.
Right. Well, welcome to the logic of the Middle East. And this is a great place to go and start talking about how complicated things can get. As you mentioned in your intro, Israel and Syria are technically still at war, but then they've had this dividing line that's been quiet for something like 40 years. For all intents and purposes, from the Israeli point of view, you had this enemy who was very predictable and basically, you were assured was not going to make trouble. And the Israelis have been clear ever since the protests started in 2011 inside Syria, and then things developed into a civil war. They've said if this spills over and becomes a security problem for us, we are going to respond. A couple interesting things about what just happened, I think, John. is number one, that Israel is openly acknowledging that it carried out airstrikes. It has, we think, carried out airstrikes in the past along the Lebanon-Syria border. We think that because they haven't sort of gone on record and talked about it, but this was to prevent weapons being transferred to Hezbollah in Lebanon. But here is the Israeli government saying, we did this. We think that the Syrian government forces were at least aiding and abetting, if not responsible for this attack. There seems to be a real clear message there from it, from Israel to the Syrian government.
And who's receiving that message and who's going to respond to it? It's not clear who is receiving messages in Syria completely right now. And speaking of quiet places, who was talking about Crimea 6 months ago? We'll have to see what scenarios could be spun that could produce chaos along this frontier. Matthew Bell, thanks so much.
Good to talk with you, John.
Matthew Bell is a former Middle East correspondent for PRI's The World. He spoke with us from Boston. Still nothing terribly new to add to the mystery of Malaysian Flight 370, and we learned today that when you have no information, you basically have no information.
I would like to take this opportunity to state that the passengers, the pilots, and the crew remain innocent until proven otherwise.
That's the acting Malaysian Transport Minister Hisamuddin Hussein at a news conference today. What the passengers and crew of Flight 370 remain, innocent or guilty, is unaccounted for. Joining us is Jennifer Pak, the BBC's Malaysia correspondent in Kuala Lumpur. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
How much are the families in this case beginning to distrust the Malaysian government and its statements of really very, very little information at this point?
I think they're extremely frustrated, and we saw a scene where there was a man and a woman believed to be the families from China, of the passengers of the people from China who were here, trying to speak to the media. Unfortunately, they were hustled away. They tried to unfurl a banner and were prevented from speaking to the media. We believe there are some police officers who tried to usher them away. I believe they tried to also get access to speak to senior Malaysian officials. There's a lot of frustration here because you have to understand that Malaysia Airlines flew in some of these family members to Malaysia, set them up in different hotels away from the media, but have been giving them caregivers or Malaysian airline officials to give them the update, which, as you rightly pointed out, is really just trickling in bit by bit. And what we're finding is that now we are in week two, and officials now say they believe the plane could possibly have been hijacked. And they are looking in completely different parts of the world now for the last point of contact they may have had with this plane. So search efforts have basically stalled at this point in time. The Malaysian acting transport minister says that they do have vessels and they have aircraft all waiting to be deployed. At this point in time, though, they're looking to get diplomatic clearance from some 11 countries, because now they're looking at the place from northern Thailand all the way up to Central Asia, or they could be looking at the area from Indonesia all the way deep into the remote parts of the Indian Ocean. This is a vast part of the world, and what it really signals is that they have been looking in the wrong place all along, and they have to start back from square one. And we are now on day 12, so family members are extremely, understandably, frustrated.
How do you reconcile the announcement by the Malaysian officials that this was a deliberate act to turn off the communications and divert the aircraft, and this notion today that the pilots and the crew remain innocent until proven otherwise? I mean, you can't reconcile those.
Indeed, you can't, and that's why it has become incomprehensible. You have to understand, though, that Malaysian officials are not used to being challenged, and they have been governing for five decades since they gained independence from the British, and they're used to controlling the message. And the traditional media here is either linked directly or indirectly to the governing coalition, which makes it very easy when they say, we will release the information when we have it. Unfortunately, this time, we have 14 different nationals on board. You have the international media that have come here day in and day out at this press conference room waiting for more updates. And the frustrating part is not so much that they are only giving information that they have verified and they are confirmed. Because I don't think anybody would disagree that they should not be giving information unless they are certain. Why people believe that they are hiding something is because the little information they do give us has been contradicted by their own people. You have the Malaysian Airlines chief contradicting statements from the acting transport minister. Unfortunately, the lack of information is giving these families false hope. And a lot of them believe that the Malaysian officials know where this aircraft is and just not telling them, which is absolutely not true. But certainly that is the impression that they have.
Finally, Jennifer, have the civilian media really opened a new chapter in the private details of the pilot and co-pilot? And how well played is that in Malaysian and Chinese media?
Certainly the information we're getting is conflicting. There doesn't seem to be a motive at this point in time. It doesn't make sense. And of course, the scrutiny is on the two pilots. But reading all of the comments from their family members, their extended family, their friends, nobody believes that they are guilty. They've been described as good neighbors. They're upstanding citizens. They have a good records. They're experienced pilots. Nobody can really find a motive. And that has added to this whole mystery and why people are so willing to believe all of the crazy theories and speculation and rumors out there that this plane could possibly still be intact at this point in time, and that the people on board are safe.
Jennifer Pak, BBC Malaysia correspondent in Kuala Lumpur. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We continue to explore and basically speculate at this point on the vast global mystery that is the disappearance of Malaysian Flight 370. Deliberate actions, we understand, switched off the plane's radar communications and appear to have abruptly altered the designated course of the airplane before its whereabouts became completely a mystery. Even figuring out what to call this incident is a challenge, whether you believe in UFOs or not. Brendan Koerner's new book is called The Skies Belong to Us, Love and Terror in the Golden Age of Hijacking. Brendan, welcome.
Thanks for having me, John.
Now, you've done a lot of writing about this Flight 370 incident, in addition to the researching of your book. Can we even call this a hijacking right now?
We really can't right now. It's one of two real possibilities. One, obviously someone took the plane deliberately and had a plan to get it out of Malaysian airspace and over the Indian Ocean. Or two, there was some kind of catastrophic fire, mechanical failure, and the shift to the west was some attempt to ameliorate that and save the passengers' lives.
You know, looking at the premeditation involved in taking control of an aircraft, whether we're talking about 9/11, whether we're talking about, you know, famous incidents in the past, or the days of the golden age of hijacking, mm-hmm. where you could just basically walk onto a plane and, you know, wave a toy gun and, and, you know, get people to fly you to Havana. What typically is the pattern for premeditated actions by people who take over aircraft?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that we view all of these incidents through the lens of 9/11, which obviously is such a traumatic event in our history. But we have to accept and realize that most hijackings in history have not followed that pattern. They've been by people who have acted alone without coordination with others, who've had personal grievances rather than real political statements they wanted to make, and who were not interested in killing people. They were interested in negotiation instead. And so when they would take over planes, they would have very good plans about how to get in the cockpit and how to perhaps make themselves seem threatening. But they did not want to take over the planes to crash it into something or kill the passengers. They wanted to use it as a bargaining chip.
And, in terms of hijacking incidents that you can recall down through history that involved this negotiation, what typically preceded the takeover of the plane?
The big thing before 9/11, the policy of the airlines was get the hijacker to the cockpit as quickly as possible so negotiations can commence. So in almost all hijackings during this golden age when it happened all the time in the 60s and 70s, it would be the presentation of a note to a flight attendant or, you know, literally someone standing up and waving a gun around, and they'd be taken right to the cockpit. After 9/11, procedures for the airlines changed when they realized that hijackers could use the planes as weapons of mass destruction. Now, of course, they lock the cockpit doors, and the pilots are instructed never to let anyone into the cockpit, no matter how many threats are being made against passengers or crew members. So it's become somewhat more complicated in that regard.
Is there any precedent for a pilot or members of the crew, a completely inside job? The Egypt Air incident appeared to have been, a member of the crew who wanted to take his own life and ended up killing everyone else. But, mm-hmm. of course, that hasn't been completely resolved. What is the precedent for a pilot or crew doing this?
Well, actually, just a month ago, we had the Ethiopian Airlines incident where an Ethiopian pilot went to Geneva and asked for asylum. So there have been precedents like that in the past, especially in the late 40s when hijacking really started in the world. The first hijackings were by pilots from the Eastern Bloc who were trying to escape to the West to go to West Berlin or Copenhagen. So there is a lengthy history of pilot-directed hijackings, but they've all been for asylum purposes pretty much.
And in terms of, again, the technology of the plane, the radar communications, the negating of the identity of the aircraft, so it couldn't even be tracked by military, what kind of expertise does that involve?
Well, I think certainly turning off the transponder is fairly easy for someone with even passing knowledge of aviation technology. Turning off the ACAR system is much more difficult.
It requires... ACAR, describe that acronym, please.
Sure. That's just sending data back about the maintenance status of the plane. And this was shut off as well in that kind of 107 to 137 a.m. time frame when the plane disappeared. That would actually require going down a trap door outside the cockpit. So that's much more complicated.
And the ACAR is really all about the manufacturer of the plane keeping track of its performance. It's not really a countermeasure for hijacking or meant to supplement the existing, you know, radar communications.
Right, exactly. So it's just another kind of detail. And the fact that it was turned off either indicates someone with a high level of sophistication carried this out, or it was just a massive catastrophe that knocked out both that and the transponder at the same time.
Do you have a theory? I mean, this doesn't fit any of the models.
It's certainly unprecedented, that's for sure. And I've gone back and forth, and it's been complicated by the dearth of good information with the Malaysian government in the situation. Right now, I'm leaning towards catastrophe, some kind of fire in the fuselage, and the pilots perhaps heroically tried to steer to the west and tried to reach an airport and were overcome by smoke or some kind of other disaster that killed them, and the plane just kept on going on its course till it ran out of fuel.
But that doesn't explain why the transponders would go off. The fire would have to have taken them out, both together.
Well, it's possible. It's also possible that the fire affected the transponder, the electronics, and the pilot switched it off and on and tried to recycle it.
Rebooting.
Exactly. And then in the middle of that, the fire overcame them.
Can you put yourself in the mind of a victim here, a family member who has no information to go on and can only speculate as wildly as we're doing here?
Yeah, it's incredibly tragic and difficult for them, I'm sure, and I really feel that they should be getting better information from the Malaysian government.
And they're certainly in a situation radically different from the passengers who were sitting in those hijacked aircraft who always believed they were going to be diverted to someplace like Havana, but never believed that their lives were nearing an end.
Yeah, that's a great point. Before 9/11, when you were on a hijacked aircraft, you assumed everything would be okay because the airline's policy was negotiate, comply totally with the hijackers, give them whatever they want, and everyone will be safe. And certainly that completely flipped around after 9/11. Once you're hijacked, you think you will be killed.
Brendan Koerner is the author of The Skies Belong to Us, Love and Terror in the Golden Age of Hijacking. He's also a contributing editor at Wired. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Annalise Silvanche from Town Center, New Jersey, has an old school story to share. My high school AP English teacher once time said, all great literature boils down to three things, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. After that, all the theory-based postmodernist approaches to literature, the rage in college classes, really didn't seem to hold much water at all. That's right, War and Peace. I love their records. Oliver Twist, what an amazing guitarist. Here's a story from Walnut Creek, California. When I was in the fourth grade, I got to dissect a pair of sheep's lungs. I was the only kid that volunteered to cut open the trachea. Ever since, I've always loved science and learn about it every day. Share something from your trachea by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
For all of the policy talk about education that happens in communities around America, learning, the imparting of essential knowledge to young people to make them citizens, that takes place right here in real schools like the ones in your neighborhood. A middle school in Tampa, Florida, in the classroom of teacher Dawn Norris.
Remember, when we talk about claim evidence, that's what I was asking you to give me. Claim evidence could be summarized by saying what? What is claim evidence in a paper? Kyle?
The evidence, it explains your claim.
It explains your claim. So what kinds of things would you use as claim evidence?
As we peek into classrooms around the nation this week, one of the issues at Monroe Middle School in Tampa is adopting the curriculum called the Common Core. It's happening all across the country, a shift to a more structured, discussion and logic-oriented approach to the teaching of writing, math, and history. John O'Connor covers education for State Impact Florida and WUSF in Tampa. He says Monroe has a lot of low-income students, and because it's located near MacDill Air Force Base, there are a lot of military families as well. O'Connor says the Common Core seems to be a good fit for Monroe right now, and you can see it and hear it in the classrooms he spent time in.
A lot of the teachers I spoke with, and this is specifically in the Tampa Bay region, say it's a significant difference for them. One of the major things is that they feel like they have to give up a little control over how the lessons actually develop in the classroom so that their job is to set the conditions for the class, set the goal for their students, and then kind of let the students get there on their own. And so when I sat in on a couple of language arts classes, the way that worked was that the teachers came in, gathered the class together, got their attention on the lesson of the day, had a kind of class-wide exercise, and then immediately they broke up into smaller groups, and the students worked together on their assignments, which the assignment was to kind of discuss fairy tales as they were told around the world and the various differences. And so the lesson was, you know, point out some of these differences, tell us, compare and contrast some of these fairy tales, and then put together an essay about it.
You know, it can be a challenge for an outsider like yourself to figure out what's going on. Here's Dawn Norris, Common Core teacher at that Monroe Middle School.
What I've noticed in my classes now is they're loud, and that's okay. Where in the old days, it was, no, you wanted that silent classroom, but the more they talk, they're all on task. They're all working on that same common goal, and that's what I think I love so much about Common Core. My room went from quiet to very loud within just a few weeks, probably.
Doing and engaged is very different from chaos. I think that's the lesson there.
Absolutely. And a lot of the teachers tell me the same thing, which is it seems like we're doing less work, but in fact we have to do a lot more work because we have to do a lot more thinking ahead of time. We have to put the kind of embedded structure into these lessons so that the kids just aren't off going in various directions wherever they want to go. They need to go towards whatever the goal is for the lesson. And in this case, they were very focused on read this text, tell me what the text says, and then make an argument backed up with things that you've learned from the text. And that there was a very clear backbone to what this lesson was in the days that I spent in these classrooms.
And that's part of what's new, as you discovered from middle school teacher Christina Phillips.
4 years ago, there wouldn't be any text in a writing assignment. It would simply be a prompt, and we would probably have kids writing a lot more anecdotes. Now they have to use the text. You know, it's what's expected at the higher level.
So fewer memoirs about how badly my parents are treating me and much more sort of text-based analysis of real writing.
Absolutely. The way I've kind of tried to characterize it in my head is it's less about what the students think and more of make an argument. And obviously, I think we understand that when you make an argument, it's a much more formal process of, you know, stating what it is you want to say and then backing it up point by point by point in kind of a structural, formal way. And, you know, that's what the teachers say their goal is in these lessons.
How does this Common Core approach overlay the, you know, very big disparities in achievement and talent and aptitude in a lot of classrooms around the country and the ones that you took a look at?
That is the kind of big unanswered question, and one of the reasons why we wanted to spend a lot of time in classrooms this spring to try and get a grip on that. The advocates for Common Core will argue this is a good thing if you're a poor student. This is a good thing if you're a student who maybe moves around a lot. Sometimes those are poor students. The middle school I went to has a high population of military students, so children of military families. So they move around a lot as well. And so what the argument is that Common Core provides a blueprint for school systems, for schools, and for teachers so that everybody's kind of on the same page and they know how to get from point A in kindergarten to point B, which would be producing a high school graduate who's ready for college or ready to enter the workforce and find a job that they could support a family with. It's unclear whether it's going to work that way or not, whether kids are going to be left behind. I spoke with former Baltimore City school administrator, a district administrator, I should say, who feels like it will work. She said, you know, for the first time, the teachers in the schools felt like, okay, here's what the map looks like. Now we know where we have to go and how fast we have to do it. But you talk to a lot of teachers who also say that when you're dealing with kids who live in poverty, who don't have enough to eat, they're going to be left behind. And if you look at the Florida testing that we have now, there's a certain percentage of kids who can't pass the test now. So if we make the test more difficult, which is expected to be the case with Common Core, you know, how are those kids going to advance?
Well, in the early going, there does seem to be some confidence in having, as you say, a map. Here's Monroe Middle School principal Kenneth Hart.
Well, I think the bottom line is it levels the playing field. It will not penalize the youngster who's in a mobile population. It will not penalize the youngster who comes from a military base in Kansas or where, and again, I'm not criticizing Kansas, but it will not penalize that youngster.
But John, is this standardization, is the argument against the Common Core that making standards too rigid really will ensure that some people are left behind?
It is a concern. I think what the advocates argue is that this structure is necessary, that, you know, if you are in third grade in Florida and you're going to be learning fractions, and if you move to another state with Common Core in third grade, you'll still be learning fractions. And so that kind of consistency will be helpful. The concern, too, though, is that it becomes too rigid and that schools don't have enough flexibility to kind of address the individual problems that they see within their own student populations.
Was middle school over your head at all when you were sitting in the class? Did anything about the curriculum intimidate you?
No, although it was really fascinating to me to see middle school kids doing things that I felt like I didn't get to until I was in high school, which was really interesting. I also sat in on an algebra class. And the algebra class felt much more familiar to me. It seemed much more like when I was in middle school and in high school taking math classes.
Well, so that's a little comforting anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
John O'Connor covers education for State Impact Florida and WUSF in Tampa. Thanks so much, John.
Thanks for having me.
So learning by doing is the theme of this educational memory from one of you in Newtonville, Massachusetts. In sixth grade, we studied civilizations for a semester and then spent a semester building our own civilization. There were two classes, an AM class and a PM class. We built our civilization in secrecy from the other class and then dug a 10x10 hole in the playground, buried our artifacts of our made-up civilization, and then had to dig up the other class's relics and piece their civilization back together. You need to tell us if you turned out to be an archaeologist there in Newtonville, Massachusetts. But we love these stories. Call us at 877-8MYTAKE. That's our number. Or you can join the conversation that's going on right now at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com, with tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.